The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. The horrific murder incidents in El Paso and Dayton have gripped the nation with fear.
I believe that a nation and that a society can be redeemed.
And resentment. Robert F. Kennedy's words should be remembered from another awful time in our nation's history.
But we have to get beyond these rather difficult times.
Meanwhile, the politicians in Sacramento busied themselves attacking First Amendment rights of California citizens.
When the state starts to dictate to pastors and counselors what is moral, what is true, what part of your faith you should be able to teach, we should be very, very concerned.
And government agents who conspired to bring President Trump down may soon answer for it.
They leveraged a foreign counterintelligence event, and that then lets them run wild.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on your digital device anytime, anywhere. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. The murderous shooting rampages in El Paso and Dayton, Ohio, that killed at least 31 and injured many more, have left us stunned and frightened. The fact that these attacks, like the attack just a week before in Gilroy, California, killed and maimed children, mothers, fathers, old and young, indiscriminately, has heightened our sense that this is cruel, this is so meaningless. It's also scary. Of course, the politicians and media did not even pause before they were ready to assign blame. Most of it was pointed at President Trump. My colleague Mark Davis had words of comfort and wisdom for many of our country. From his program, heard each weekday morning on 660 AM The Answer in Dallas.
If there's ever an idea that comes to you because of a horrible news event, if there's an idea, a policy, and it seems to be born of the white hot cauldron of emotion, think five times before doing it, because it may not be a good idea. It may just be you so desperately wanting to do something. Oh, my God, we got to do something and we got to do it now. When you should know that the real solution to all these shootings is to rediscover God in our nation, to rediscover personal responsibility, to care for each other better, to pay more attention to mental health. That's what solves the problem. And that's not done by law. And there's no glad handing press conference featuring politicians. It's us. It's us and it's God. It's us relying on him and following his guidance. It's the easiest thing in the world. Rather than sitting there figuring out for 47 hours and giving me, man, what is the right thing to do? Guess what? Got a book that'll tell you right now. Took us a long time to slide into this pit of hell that our culture seems to be sliding toward. It'll take a little time to get us out. But I will never believe that the horse is out of the barn. I will never believe that the toothpaste is out of the tube. I believe that people can be redeemed. I'm living proof of that. I know others who are as well, and I believe that a nation and that a society can be redeemed. So in the meantime, it's like, well, we've got, blood-stained Walmart and crime scene tape across an entire street and a neighborhood in Dayton, and we want to do something ideally by this weekend. What can we do? So along comes this idea of gun violence restraining orders. It would bring about some good results. The idea, if you haven't heard, is that close friends, family members, people with standing would bring meeting a high evidence bar and say, listen, Uncle Fred has said things or done things that are sufficiently alarming that a judge might say he's a potential harm to himself or others. And so we suspend Uncle Fred's gun rights for 30, 60, 90 days. What could go wrong? Answer is everything. It's a human system. And I know that there's no way to avoid it. We can't have, you know, robots and computers doing law. God help us. Everything's a human system. So in things that we have to do, temporary restraining orders, for a woman threatened by some crazy ex-husband. I mean, there are things we have to do, and it's a human system. And so you just got to take those human failings. We don't have to do this. Because if, you know, everybody says, hey, if one life is saved, I'm going to come at it from another way. If one person is improperly denied a basic fundamental constitutional right, it's a deal breaker. It just is. And I don't think it would be one person. I think it would be a lot. And I will never be willing to subject your constitutional rights to the behavioral vicissitudes of some judge or some hacked off family member. Now, I've said 4 or 5 times that the system should be resistant to vendettas, grudges, somebody who just looked at you crosswise. Let's say we plug in all these gun violence restraining orders. Oh, we feel great. We did something. Yay us. Pat ourselves on the back. And then we have some other terrible shooting in some American city, 30 more people dead. Oh, bar the door, man, bar the door. Because suddenly Uncle Norman, who was just kind of edgy last week, he's a potential killer this week. And Judge Joe Blow, he wants to strike his blow for safety in America. And he's going to go get Uncle Norman's guns. God bless the police. They can't be everywhere. We are everywhere by definition because we are everyone. And the more of us who are armed, the safer we all are from the monsters among us. Here's the greatest usefulness of keeping ourselves safe. Number one, us, the law-abiding American, using our unmitigated Second Amendment rights. Nothing works better than the armed citizen. Us, police in particular, government in general. That's the hierarchy of protection. That we should don't go look into government first. Don't go look into the police first. Look to yourself first. It is your job to protect yourself, your home, and your family. The first responders are parents. Before a first responder has to come to a place where your son is shot up a street or a Walmart, how about if you be a first responder when your kid starts throwing off disturbing behaviors? How about you be a first responder as a dad or a mom to rein in your kid's screen time? How about you be a first responder if your little angel is an obvious bully and you're not doing anything about it? You be the first responder so that other first responders, you know, wearing police uniforms don't have to respond to something god-awful that your kid did because you didn't respond enough.
You can catch the full comments from Mark at townhallreview.com. Over the course of this past week, I've spoken to so many leaders and pundits about the mayhem and the sickness in our land. I think you'll appreciate the wisdom of Richard Haass. The president of the Council for Foreign Relations joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to contrast the rhetoric we are wallowing in the aftermath of the murderous rampages in El Paso and Dayton with Robert Kennedy on the night of the assassination of Martin Luther King. I want to play this for you in the audience.
For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times.
Richard Haass, have you heard even one political figure of left, right, or center approach that approach in dealing with the aftermath of El Paso and Dayton?
No one in our leadership is doing that. It's so poignant and so sad. And also, you know, the other thing that came to mind was George W. Bush after 9/11 going to a mosque and making clear that our problem was not with Muslims. It was simply with the individuals who did the terrible hijacking. Now it's almost the politics are going just the opposite. We're going from the specific to the general.
There have been 36 mass murders, according to Tebby Troy, since George W. Bush took office. I began the show in July of 2000. We're trying to assign them as proxies of political parties now, which is, to me, just so damn destructive. We had 159 race-related riots, leaving 85 people dead and 2,100 injured in 1967, We had riots after Martin Luther King's assassination, 40 people dead, 2,500 injured. We had 11,000 dead in Vietnam in 67, 16,000 in 68, 11,000. We're not anything close to 67 through 71 at this point. Do you think we are?
I think in some ways we're worse. We don't know anything as dominant as Vietnam, either in the casualties and deaths it caused or in the way it, as a single issue, it dominated American society. But I'm much more worried about the United States now. I think we're much more divided along many more fault lines. I think our political process isn't working in so many ways. I think the number of people who feel alienated from this society, I actually think things are much worse. And for at the risk of getting melodramatic, for the first time, I don't feel comfortable or I don't assume that everything's just going to work its way out. Again, my question is whether we have the same capacity to self-correct. When you and I grew up, we knew only a couple of broadcasts. There was much more of a common story.
To find my complete interview with Richard Haass, go to townhallreview.com. Almost immediately after the El Paso event, people struggled to name the perpetrator's ideology. It was a complicated business. My Salem colleague, Larry Elder, examined his so-called manifesto from The Larry Elder Show.
We're hearing about the manifesto, so-called manifesto, that was posted online, now been taken down. And we're hearing about the parts of the manifesto that have to do with white nationalism and his hostility towards race mixing. The manifesto is called The Inconvenient Truth. Let me focus on political reasons. He says this: in short, America is rotting from the inside out, and peaceful means to stop this seem to be nearly impossible. The inconvenient truth is that our leaders, both Democrat and Republican, have been failing us for decades. America will soon become a one-party state. The Democratic Party will own America, and they know it, by pandering heavily to the Hispanic voting bloc. He writes, they intend to use open borders, free health care for illegals, citizenship, and more to enact a political coup by importing and then legalizing millions of new voters. He said this: the heavy Hispanic population in Texas will make us a Democratic stronghold. Losing Texas and a few other states with heavy Hispanic populations to the Democrats is all it would take for them to win nearly every presidential election. Although the Republican Party is also terrible, many factions within the Republican Party are pro-corporation and pro-immigration. So he's not a big fan of Democrats or Republicans. He complained about how corporations were spoiling the environment. Not something that you normally hear from right-wingers. He also complained about the cost of college. He says the value of college has declined as their cost has increased. Quote, this has led, he writes, to a generation of debt, of indebted, overqualified students filling menial, low-paying, and unfulfilling jobs. He also, by the way, said that people are going to blame Donald Trump on this shooting. And he said in his manifesto, I've had these thoughts for a very long time. Don't blame Trump.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
When the state starts to dictate to pastors and counselors what is moral, what is true, what part of your faith you should be able to teach, we should be very, very concerned.
Sacramento once again attacks First Amendment rights. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. With supermajorities for Democrats in both houses of the California State Legislature, they seem more interested in social engineering than fixing infrastructure or much of anything else, actually. Ed Martin took a turn with Greg Burt of the California Family Council to talk about the latest effort to chill speech coming out of Sacramento. They spoke on Salem's 1170 The Answer in San Diego.
Well, tell me what this is. What are they trying to do here? It looks like it's kind of the left attacking our churches, but walk me through what they're really, what they think they're going to do and what's going on here.
Sure. We have California legislators here in Sacramento really attacking the First Amendment protections for pastors. We have a resolution. It's Assembly Concurrent Resolution 99, which is proposed by the LGBT caucus, and it directly tells churches and counselors that they should no longer be helping people to deal with their unwanted same-sex attraction or gender confusion, because that type of counseling, they have determined it's ineffective, unethical, and harmful. And even wow. beyond that, they are blaming pastors who have conservative views on sexuality for the high suicide rates and depression rates within the LGBT community.
Not everybody in America is required to believe what you and I believe about the Lord, about marriage. But my goodness, we've always been allowed to believe that ourselves and have our churches do it. This seems like California is going further than ever, right into the heart of religious liberty at its face, right?
No, exactly. And even individuals, don't we have a right under the Constitution to decide how we are going to pursue happiness? That really choice should be up to us. We should have the right to go to therapy, to pick our own counseling goals. It is up to each individual to decide exactly how they want to live. And the state is now saying, no, you cannot have that goal. If you're confused about your gender, you need to follow your feelings. When the state starts to dictate to pastors and counselors, we should be very, very concerned.
So they're doing this. Is it going to pass? I mean, so this basically, the assembly's got a resolution 99 that's basically aimed at saying, you know, we're going to force conservatives. This is my problem. It's all, everybody thinks it's good to have like hate crimes, all these things, until someone else defines what hate is. It's pretty soon being a Christian is going to be considered hate. Is it likely to pass? Are there enough people in the California Assembly, even Democrats, who think it's okay to go right at the heart of communities of faith, whether Christian, Jewish, whatever? Is this likely to pass?
Well, it's already passed the Assembly, so now it's before the Senate. So we are waiting for the hearing before the Judiciary Committee. But it's, you know, here in California, we are dominated by over 75% are Democrats. And so it looks like it's going to go and pass. You know, this is a resolution, so this is not a law. It's declaring to pastors and counselors, here's what the state thinks about what you're doing. But it's really about scaring pastors and counselors into silence. Because you got the whole state government now saying, you know, we are against you, and what you are doing is causing people to kill themselves, right? Your right. Christian morality is so dangerous that we need to stop you from saying it in public, right? Christian morality on sex has always been unpopular, right? What state has ever tried to imply that it's dangerous enough to ban?
The USA is one of the few countries in the world where presidential election and the transfer of power is done smoothly and peacefully. But that would not be the best way to describe what has happened in 2016. It is now clear that there were efforts, beginning early in 2016, to undermine one of the two campaigns, the Trump campaign. And much of that work was done by largely unaccountable bureaucrats. What you'll hear some refer to as the deep state, what I call the permanent government. My colleague Sebastian Gorka turned to Chris Farrell, Director of Investigations and Research at Judicial Watch.
What is the big picture here? What happened at the end of the election in 16 and afterwards that Americans need to see crystal clear?
Well, it's actually even leading up to the election.
Yes.
So a handful of persons in the Department of Justice and the FBI engaged in a seditious conspiracy to undermine and infiltrate the campaign of Donald Trump and then carry that forward to both destabilize the transition and then actively undermine the Trump administration in the early days. And they did so using a counterintelligence investigation as the vehicle, as the device.
Not a criminal one, a counterintelligence
one. Well, that's a thing I'll argue with people over. Counterintelligence investigations are criminal investigations. It's 18 U.S.C. It's the same. It's a criminal code that all the espionage acts are under. But what they do is they leveraged a foreign counterintelligence event, and the FBI deliberately manufactured that event in the UK, which is the friendliest overseas operating environment for the FBI. And they set that in motion in the UK so that they could then import back into the US a foreign counterintelligence event or situation. And that then lets them run wild. The reason for that is they had to have a foreign event, call it a counterintelligence investigation, then bring it back to the
U.S. Use that as a pretext.
And then they run wild. And that's exactly what they did. And they did it very deliberately, because the alternative was to get a letter from Attorney General Loretta Lynch saying, okay, go ahead, penetrate the Trump campaign.
Yeah.
And there's no way they didn't want a piece of paper like that floating around.
How does Robert Mueller and the last 2.5 years fit into that, Chris Farrell?
It's Weissman and a collection of folks.
Buddies of Hillary.
Correct. And they're all the operatives who are trying to advance the story. And what's really pathetic is you have a guy who's falsely accused named Donald Trump. He's fed up and aggravated by being lied about.
As any normal American would be.
Yeah, it's a great word, calumny. It's an old word, yes. But it's a good word.
Hard to pronounce, but important.
False swearing to destroy someone's reputation. He's fed up with that, and he fights back and says, no, this is garbage. You're lying about me. Knock it off.
The real actor now we need to be focused on is U.S. Attorney Durham, correct?
Correct. I mean, the Department of the Inspector General's office is normally a department of cover-ups. I jokingly, not really jokingly, sadly say that the IG is where the truth goes to die. That's normally what happens. He writes a report that's really an administrative review of the organization's internal operations.
Yeah.
It's administrative. It's not a criminal document.
Right.
And so it's not written in that way. It's written to, you know, mistakes were made, passive voice type of language. There could be stuff in there that's good, but anybody who's hanging their hat on it and saying, oh, boy, this is going to be the big ta-da. No, it's not.
That means a grand jury. That
correct.
Means charges. Nothing short of that really matters.
Correct. Correct. Okay. You need a grand jury, need indictments, need people to go to trial. Everything else is hot air.
Now, you're a former military intelligence professional. You know how catching bad guys and putting them behind bars works.
Correct.
What is the, where does the wise prosecutor begin? Where does the wise investigator begin? Give us the perspective from the person building a case.
Right. So start with the elements of the crime. Right. Because you have got to satisfy the elements of the crime.
Right.
If you're not, you're wasting your time. So that's number one. What are the objectives? And it's laid out in very clear language. They know they have to have a reasonable belief that they're going to achieve that, or don't even bother wasting your time. Once you've established, once you know exactly what you're going for with respect to the elements of the crime, then you go back and there's already a ton of stuff on the record. Thank goodness. And then you say, OK, well, you know, who do we know is dead in the water and can they be leaned on? McCabe, Strzok. Page, you know, probably I think the most malleable of them all right now would probably be Page. She's an attorney by training. She knows what happened. The demeanor and behavior of Strzok and McCabe is remarkably arrogant, and that's part of the disease of being an FBI special agent.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Boris has a Churchillian sense of destiny. He loves his country. He is very much against the nanny state. He's a positive, uplifting, charismatic person.
Boris Johnson in the crucible of British politics. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I am Hugh Hewitt. Over the past few years, as he was growing in prominence, Britain's new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has been seen as a caricature more than as a statesman. The source of this, we have to admit, he's earned some of that with his antics as mayor of London. But the question now is Boris up to the Brexit task? Likely so, says James Dellingpool. Breitbart's executive editor in Britain was a guest of Sebastian Gorka.
Is the fact that Boris Johnson, a man who has certain Trumpian factors to his character, is now your new prime minister, are we back on track for Brexit? Is the UK now reassured of having some kind of modicum of national sovereignty reasserted, James Dellingpool?
I don't want to tempt fate by overblowing our chances,
but
I think that this could be the moment. I mean, you think about it. We had our Trumpian revolution, or rather we had our intimations of a Trumpian revolution before President Trump came into power.
Right.
We had our Brexit, and we thought This is it. This is our moment. We've voted to free ourselves from the European socialist superstate, this sclerotic, corrupt, socialistic structure, a bit like a kind of soft Soviet Union.
Just remind everybody what really happened, because it was 3 years ago plus that you had a referendum on as to whether the UK should leave the European Union, and you had the biggest result in British history. 17 million people, the most who have ever voted one way on an issue, voted yes, let's leave. Yeah. And now we are, what, 3+ years later? It hasn't happened, but Theresa May has folded. Boris Johnson is now in the chair. So talk to us about what that means for the UK.
Well, what it could finally mean is that we have a government which is willing and able, possibly, to deliver on the referendum result that we had 3 years ago. You're right, 17.4 million people voted to leave the European Union, more people than have voted for anything in British history. But that wasn't the only remarkable part. The really remarkable part was this was done in the teeth of opposition from pretty much the entirety of the establishment.
But I have to challenge you. I have to ask this question, because I've read a lot of stuff in the last 3 weeks that Bojo talks a good talk. Boris Johnson talks a good talk, but he doesn't walk the good walk. And that it's about Boris Johnson all the time. It's not about things greater than him. What is James Dellingpole's response to that analysis?
Boris is often accused of being like Donald Trump, and
that's a good thing.
Shares certain similarities in that the hair, number one.
Yes,
he's got this short,
the blonde mane,
blonde hair.
Right.
Yeah. Boris is he has a sense of humour.
Yes,
he doesn't like. In the same way that President Trump uses Twitter as if to say, look, I am the leader of the free world. I'm the most important person in the world. If I can't say what I like, who can? And Boris is very much like that. He sails very close to the wind in his political commentary and gets himself into all manner of trouble for saying true things in a humorous way. Boris has a Churchillian sense of destiny. He's patriotic. He loves his country. He is also, I think, very much against the nanny state. These are all good qualities that he's got. He's a positive, uplifting, charismatic person. The downside with Boris is, well, two main flaws, I would say, he's got. One, he quite likes to be liked.
Mm.
You know, unlike Trump, he's wary of sticking it in really hard to the enemy.
Right.
The second thing is that he's not really ideological. So he's not really a red meat conservative like you and I are. So there's a danger that he could get distracted.
But what is his center when it comes to the bureaucracy of the EU? Is he going to deliver Brexit?
I think my money is on him delivering Brexit. If you look at the Boris's cabinet,
yes,
they are certainly the most right-wing cabinet we've had since Margaret Thatcher's era. And indeed, even Margaret Thatcher herself did not have quite as conservative a cabinet as that.
For the complete Gorka Dellingpole interview, go to townhallreview.com. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
David French said that it, quote, sent shockwaves through the conservative Christian establishment. And just like that, millions of American Christians could easily and quickly imagine a future where the law held their traditional Orthodox religious beliefs in the same regard as it held the views of vile racists.
Al Mohler, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Al Mohler, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, has been a personal friend and Salem colleague of mine for some 20 years now. Simply put, though, when Dr. Mohler speaks, I listen. And when he sees ominous clouds gathering over religious liberty in the U.S.,
I listen very closely. In a recent segment from his morning briefing, Mueller looked at a Wall Street Journal debate on the topic.
Is religious liberty truly in peril? That was the argument that appeared in print recently in the Wall Street Journal. Arguing for the fact that religious liberty is endangered in America was David French, senior writer for National Review magazine. He also writes for Time. Arguing that religious liberty is not in peril in the United States was Marcy Hamilton. Earlier, she had clerked for former Justice of the Supreme Court Sandra Day O'Connor. She's now a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. The first argument was by French, arguing, yes, religious liberty is in peril. He goes back to April the 28th, 2015, a date to which I have also often returned. It was the oral arguments in the case known as Obergefell v. Hodges. That was the case that eventually, by decision of the Supreme Court, legalized same-sex marriage across the country. But the most ominous and telling moment in the oral arguments for that case came when Donald Verrilli, Jr., who was the Solicitor General of the United States, was being asked questions by the Chief Justice, John G. Roberts, Jr., and also by other justices, most importantly, Justice Samuel Alito. As David French writes, quote, Justice Samuel Alito asked President Barack Obama, Solicitor General Donald Verrilli, whether constitutional recognition for same-sex marriage would lead to stripping federal tax exemptions from religious colleges that oppose gay marriage, in the same way that federal law strips tax exemptions from colleges that oppose interracial marriage or interracial dating. Rather than immediately answering no, the Solicitor General of the United States responded, quote, it's certainly going to be an issue, end quote. Indeed, of course, it's going to become an issue. It's going to be an issue not just when it comes to tax exemptions. It's going to be an issue when it comes to any form of social recognition. The big question here is whether or not Christian colleges will be able to continue operating as colleges that are Christian. And it's not just colleges and universities. It's going to be expanded, as we already know. Just about every ministry eventually is likely to be confronted with this question, if not the outright threat. Writing of that exchange in the oral arguments, David French said that it, quote, sent shockwaves through the conservative Christian establishment. And just like that, millions of American Christians could easily and quickly imagine a future where the law held their traditional Orthodox religious beliefs in the same regard as it held the views of vile racists. But Christians, he wrote, who had been paying attention knew of this risk well before Obergefell. Christians who had been paying attention had seen a trend where legal activists at all levels of government had been aggressively expanding their regulatory and ideological attacks on religious liberty, end quote. One of the most important issues in French's article is where he honestly underlines the fact that the chief threat is coming from what is rightly described as the administrative state. This is the vast bureaucracy of government. Just consider how this works. Go back to the Obama administration and its infamous contraception mandate. The administration made that mandate, most importantly, through a bureaucracy, the Department of Health and Human Services, a ruling that became a policy of the administrative state that violated the Christian consciences of many employers. And, of course, it was during the Obama administration and because of the Department of Health and Human Services that a group of Catholic nuns known as the Little Sisters of the Poor filed suit in federal court against that federal department precisely because of the violation of Christian conscience. We also need to note that the administration could have accomplished the same purpose without violating Christian conscience, without violating the consciences of those Roman Catholic nuns, without violating the consciences of evangelical Christian employers. It all could have been done otherwise, but it wasn't, which means that it was actually calculated and deliberate. But the administrative state has taken similar kinds of actions through other departments, including the Department of Justice and the Department of Education, especially when it comes to funding and higher education policy. French writes, quote, the list could go on, but more disturbing than the individual cases is the deep inversion of America's constitutional principles that has empowered this legal assault. If governments ultimately prevail in these efforts, he warns, the resulting precedents would upend the constitutional order, rendering religious Americans even more vulnerable to future legal attacks, like the threatened loss of tax exemptions for Christian educational institutions. Marcy Hamilton wrote her own article, even as David French did, but both French and Hamilton responded to one another. The most important section of the entire exchange is probably a single paragraph in Marcy Hamilton's response to David French. She writes, quote, David French says that our constitutional tradition does not give religious believers absolute rights, even as he argues that they should be free in most instances from laws that they consider incompatible with their beliefs. But there is only one absolute right in the Constitution, and that is the First Amendment's guarantee of the right to believe anything you want. The government may never prescribe beliefs, end quote. Now, that's a very strong statement. It's also an extremely erroneous statement, and thus a very dangerous statement. There is no language in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution about a right to believe anything you want. What we're actually seeing here is Marcy Hamilton, teaching at the University of Pennsylvania, reducing the actual language of the U.S. Constitution, of the very First Amendment and the Bill of Rights, to nothing more than the right to believe anything you want. Now, we have seen how religious liberty has been verbally constricted and redefined in just the past generation. During the Obama years, it became increasingly common to hear the U.S. government and its officials refer to religious liberty not as religious liberty or religious freedom, but rather freedom or liberty of worship. But freedom of worship is certainly included in religious liberty, but it doesn't end there. By referring to religious liberty merely as a freedom of worship, it means it's fine for you to do whatever you want to do in your synagogue, in your mosque, in your temple, or in your church. Just don't bring it into public. And when it comes to Marcy Hamilton's argument, where she says there is only one absolute right in the Constitution, and that is the First Amendment's guarantee of the right to believe anything you want, now you see that it's just a matter of individual belief. It's actually, if you take her words at face value, basically what goes on in your own head, or sentimentally, in your own heart. So now it's not even freedom of worship. It's just freedom of belief. Now the sphere of meaning in which this right is respected is reduced from the public square, including corporations, the schools, the government, the public square writ large, reduced not only from that to the church or the synagogue or the temple or the mosque, but now basically reduced to your cranium, period.
Coming up.
Thousands of illegal immigrants coming here seeking asylum, and this is what the president is trying to get at, is try to solve some of this asylum problem.
Congresswoman Debbie Lesko in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, Max Lucado gives advice on dealing with the tragedies in Dayton and El Paso.
The truth of the matter is, until we get to heaven, we do not know why some of these things have been allowed.
We look at the problem.
We've got a society which tells people over and over again in every way that human life is a meaningless burp in the cosmos.
And we examine proposed solutions.
Gun control, it's a net that I wish we could swat so we could work on the real problem.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The recent House Judiciary hearing with Special Counsel Robert Mueller showcased some newer, lesser-known lawmakers. One who stood out was Arizona Congresswoman Debbie Lesko. Her fair questioning of Mueller stood out amidst the media circus at the recent appearance of the special counsel. Congresswoman Lesko is also the driving force behind several new immigration bills. She was a guest of Seth Leibson on AM 960, The Patriot, in Phoenix.
And I just wanted you to talk a little bit, basically the thrust of what it is you're proposing on these issues.
Yeah, I've introduced six immigration bills, and basically they're targeting at trying to help mitigate the crisis that we have at the border. The first one, and probably the most important one, is it would increase the credible fear standards to gain asylum into our country.
Right.
Because right now, we have all these people coming over. The cartels know that we have very low standards to get in for asylum.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're charging all of these illegal migrants that are coming here like $5,000, $6,000 apiece. They're making tons of money off of them, saying, come now, because you just go over there, tell them you're asking for asylum, and they're so overloaded at the border that you're just going to be left into the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happening now. And we don't have enough immigration judges. And so there's thousands of illegal immigrants coming here seeking asylum, and this is what the president is trying to get at, is try to, you know, solve some of this asylum problems, because instead of the illegals running away from Border Patrol, now they're just, like, turning themselves into the Border Patrol saying, oh, I'm seeking asylum, and then the first hurdle that they need to cross is a very low hurdle.
Right.
And so once they're here, they're in.
It's a very sad and tragic thing that they would use the penury and the victim the victimhood of these illegal immigrants who spend a lot of money to pay off these cartels and keep the system operating like this. I think it's tragic.
It is very tragic. You're absolutely right. And when I hear Chairman Jerry Nadler and the Judiciary Committee call our law enforcement at the border child abusers.
Yeah.
He said they should be held for negligent homicide. I mean, just radical statements made by the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and other Democrats. And it really hurts the morale of the men and women that are doing the best they can at the border with just thousands of families coming over. There's not enough space for them. I just saw a picture recently where one of the women, Border Patrol officers, was holding a young child, migrant. I mean, these are men and women at our law enforcement, at our border. They have their own families, too. They care about these people.
Yeah.
They are spending a lot of their time carting them to hospitals, you know, doing things that they're not trained to do. And so for the Democrats to continually demonize them is just, it's just terrible.
I
just can't
too.
Stand it.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Mike Cook, Dwayne Patterson, and Adam Ramsey. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. If you liked our program, tell a friend to sign up for the podcast. Start at townhallreview.com. Follow us on Twitter at Town Hall Review, and join us again next time.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.